Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The discovery of a mass grave site of 215 Indigenous children at a former Indian residential school in British Columbia, Canada last month has received international media attention. For the first time, many are learning that Canada's residential schools were modeled after the Indian boarding school system here in the United States. The first Indian boarding school in the U.S. was established in 1879 by Colonel Richard Henry Pratt, whose motto was "Kill the Indian, save the man." He ran the off-reservation government-funded Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania for 25 years. That school closed in 1918, but the last Indian boarding school did not close until 1978. Historians estimate there were more than 350 U.S. Indian boarding schools and day schools, more than double the number in Canada. About one-third of the U.S. schools were managed by various Christian denominations, but the Catholic Church dominated the field with about 100. Unlike Canada, the United States has never had an accurate count of the number of Indian boarding schools or the number of children who attended or died at the schools. Researchers believe mass graves also exist in the United States. The U.S. government has never formally apologized for its Indian boarding schools. According to data collected by the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, by the year 1900, there were about 20,000 children in boarding schools. By 1925, that number had more than tripled. Families that refused to send their kids to these schools faced consequences like prison time at Alcatraz. Families also camped out near the schools to be near their children, but many were forbidden from seeing them. Indigenous communities in the U.S. are calling on the government to finally acknowledge its role in attempting to destroy Native cultures, languages, and families. Joining us to talk about this is Mary Annette Pember, a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. Mary Annette Pember is a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. She was the first Native woman staff photographer at four newspapers, including the Arizona Republic and the Oregonian. Mary has been writing about Indian boarding schools for 30 years. Last year, her year-long type investigations report found that for the greater part of the 20th century, the federal government routed funds designated as direct payments for Native people to Catholic mission schools, draining Native families of $30 million by today's measures. Mary Annette Pember's mom, Bernice, was a survivor of the St. Mary's Catholic Indian boarding school on the Ojibwe Reservation in Odinna, Wisconsin. Mary writes that everything was taken from her: her parents, her language, her Indian name, and her very spirit. Bernice passed on September 19th, 2011, and you can find Mary's writings about her mom at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Mary. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for all of your work on these issues.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Mary. First off, what was your reaction when you heard news about the mass grave site that was found in Canada?
Well, in some ways, I think that the use of mass grave might not be totally correct. I think they are certainly unmarked graves. For me, mass grave implies perhaps like a single violent act in which a number of people were buried, you know, died at once and were buried. I think that I don't think that happened in Kamloops. I think that they were probably just they were unmarked, or if they were marked at one time, you know, it was rather hasty, and you know, the was just as a result of years and weathering, the designations have, you know, just disappeared. And I think that is probably the case, certainly in the United States. Most of the schools had some kind of cemetery associated with them. And, you know, I'm sure a number of kids, you know, and at that time, I mean, you know, this, we're thinking prior to antibiotics and various things, a lot of kids did die at the schools. So when I first heard that, I was like, wow, well, it's taken folks quite some time to be aware of this. And we were not, Native people were not shocked. We've kind of been shocked that it's taken so long for the United States to have any kind of awareness that this is very much a part of our history here.
Why do you think this has taken so long? I was just thinking, we've done, you know, several shows about this over the years, but when these stories break, I feel like we're starting back at square one. Why is that?
You know, I've been around for a while, and I've been doing this work for a while as a journalist, and Indians periodically, Native people in the United States will develop some sort of cachet or media interest. You know, Standing Rock is a good case in point. And prior to that would have been maybe the occupation at Alcatraz or at Wounded Knee. But, you know, I think some of it is reflective of, you know, folks' attention span here. They go about a quarter inch deep into something and maybe they just become disinterested or bored. But it still surprises me that people really have very little knowledge about this. But in general, I mean, if we look at the way that Native history is taught, U.S. history in general is taught in our schools, there's really very little accurate information, you know, or complete information offered to students. It's sort of more in the form of what I would describe as kind of like fairy tales.
I mean, it's also shocking when you think about it, how long it's taken for Native people to have seats in Congress. And I wonder if you think that someone like Deb Haaland, who is now the first Native to serve as a cabinet secretary, U.S. Interior Secretary, she wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post last week called "My Grandparents Were Stolen from Their Families as Children. We Must Learn About This History." Do you think that having someone like Deb Haaland in this high position could change things?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. You know, before she was appointed as Secretary of the Interior, she and Senator Elizabeth Warren forwarded a bill in 2020, which is called the Truth and Healing Commission on Boarding School Policy in the United States. It was an act, and it failed, died in Congress. So I actually just spoke with Senator Warren's media person, and she is planning to forward that bill again. So, you know, it would not, I think, be modeled so much on the Canadian Indian Settlement Act, which also included financial reparations to boarding school they call them residential schools there, residential school survivors. You know, I think our legal system is quite different from Canada, and Canada actually had to make a great deal of changes in order to give these financial settlements to people. I don't see that happening in the U.S., but I think just a reckoning, just a transparency, that would mean a great deal to Native people. It certainly would mean a great deal to me.
You've written about this Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was brought up by Representative Haaland and, as you said, Senator Warren. Why did this die in Congress when it was first introduced? Do you know?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. I didn't follow it, but I'm not surprised. I'm sure it was just, you know, it was really not seen as terribly important. I think that we're starting to gain, in general, more understanding of the impact of past trauma on people. You know, when a lot of bad stuff happens to you and to your family and to your parents, you know, it's no surprise that, you know, you might not do so well.
Right.
And I think we're gaining a little bit more understanding about that. You know, and the boarding schools in the United States were just another of a whole series of assimilation policies that the federal government forwarded that, you know, in fact, actually did traumatize Native people a great deal. But one of the things I did want to mention, I think it's extremely important, you know, Native people are often cast as, you know, as victims. You know, we're kind of, I always joke that we're kind of the gold standard for despair and victimhood. But in fact, Native families are incredibly resilient. I mean, if we weren't resilient, we wouldn't still have as many languages that we have still actively spoken today. People are still engaged, you know, in their cultural activities and their ceremonies. Native people are incredibly scrappy. And there are many, you know, instances in which, you know, some of the missionaries in particular are very enthusiastic about forwarding their religion and would try to encourage Native people to destroy their sacred items and to, you know, eschew their spirituality. But people went underground and those things survived. So that, you know, myself and my children, that we can still go to ceremony with our families is truly remarkable to me. I wonder if you know, perhaps other groups of folks would have done so well, you know. So in some ways, I mean, I think it does really speak to our incredible resilience.
This is such a good point, Mary, and that's why I emphasize the word attempt. when we said Native communities are calling on the U.S. to acknowledge its role in attempting to destroy Native cultures, languages, and families, because it can often seem in the media that the United States was successful in its goal, and it wasn't. I mean, it did so much damage, obviously, but as you say, as Native people say, we're still here.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and what comes to mind, a good example is not long ago, there was a birch bark scroll that my people, the Ojibwe people, years ago, prior to contact, we recorded our ceremonies and also various teachings, you know, perhaps historical records on birch bark scrolls and in symbols. And the White Earth Band of Ojibwe in Minnesota, they were able to reclaim one of these scrolls. I think it was being sold like on an art auction site, and the art auction site did, you know, agree to return it to the White Earth Band. But I've seen photographs of it, and actually some of the symbols are meaningful to me now in my participation in ceremony and our teachings, and that, you know, that's truly remarkable. I mean, that is, I don't think it's been accurately dated yet, but you're talking about some of these scrolls are, you know, they're 600, 800 years old. So that, you know, a woman here in 2021, I mean, I didn't understand all of it, of course, but that these symbols were familiar to me. I think that speaks volumes.
It really does. And to your point, there was an amazing post yesterday on the Social Distance Powwow Facebook page by Deborah Kawanaron Stock, who writes, "I am Mohawk, originally from Quebec, Canada. I created this ribbon skirt in honor of the 215 children found in Kamloops. In my mind, they are happy, running to their mothers in the sky world. The numbers 215 are in sky domes on each side of the skirt. I'm grateful to my grandmother and mother, both residential school survivors, for teaching me the true meaning of resilience." The skirt is not for sale, as she mentioned in her post, but it's so beautiful. It's orange, and there are these just beautiful photos of children with long dark hair running toward a mom who's right in the middle with long dark hair. And I think this just speaks to what you talked about communities being resilient.
Yeah, and then the other thing, you know, to remember is, you know, the boarding school stories. You know, they're very nuanced and variable. Some people, there are Native people alive today who speak very fondly of their boarding school experience. And I think there were a lot of, elements that went into defining that. It depended on what school you went to, when you went to it. Some people were able to go with a number of their siblings. And some people went to schools where they would have day programs. And my aunt, for instance, was a day scholar, while my mother, whose family was just really had a lot of, were having a lot of difficulties and was kind of disintegrating, she and her siblings ended up boarding. So if you were able to, you know, to get back with your family, I mean, they could counter a lot of that negative messaging that you got at the boarding schools.
You know, you just brought up a memory for me, because my grandfather went to a boarding school and he never talked about it, but my dad took him on a road trip to the school, and it was the one story he shared. He wanted to be a woodworker, but the woodworking teacher used to slap him in the face. And so then he took a sheet metal class, and the sheet metal teacher was nice to him. And so my grandfather became a sheet metal worker, and my dad became a sheet metal worker. And so it's amazing how it's just still with families, as you say, so many different stories.
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, that is really important to remember. And also, you know, the real heyday of the federal boarding schools really took place in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And they began to change, later in the 20th century. The Catholic Church actually did run quite a number of boarding schools, mission schools, because they already had missions established. So, you know, they operated on a somewhat of a different model. So it was not as though, when we talk about there's like, they say potentially between 350 to 400 boarding schools in the U.S., they didn't operate concurrently, you know. Some were only open for, you know, a couple of years. A lot of people that went there, I think the overwhelming lesson was often one of that something was really essentially wrong with Native people. It was something in need of correction. You needed to abandon your old ways because they were wrong. They were no longer suitable. So that message of being really intrinsically wrong, that's very diminishing for people's, you know, psyches and for their spirituality, I think. And that's something we do find a lot of people will talk about that.
Before we talk about your mom's story, let's talk about some history. In an Atlantic piece you wrote about your mom, you write that on March 3rd, 1819, the Civilization Fund Act ushered in an era of assimilationist policies leading to the Indian boarding school era, which lasted from 1860 to 1978. And you have a link in there to the Equal Justice Initiative, and they have some information about the Civilization Fund Act, which paid missionaries and church leaders to partner with the U.S. government to establish schools in Indian territories to teach Native children to replace tribal practices with Christian practices. I'm guessing, Mary, that most people have never heard of this Civilization Fund Act.
Yeah, well, that started, you know, well, it was considered quite forward-thinking. They wanted people of good moral character, as it was defined. If you read get down into the weeds of the act, and those people were seen as Christians and primarily at that time Protestants. And then of course the Catholics were able to make a way for themselves as well. So, yes, a lot of, you know, the missionaries, well, they were already present. They already had a presence in Indian country. And so it sort of made sense that they would, the federal government would rely upon them.
In 1824, the federal government established the Bureau of Indian Affairs to oversee this fund and implement programs to, quote, civilize the native people. I mean, the fact that it's called the Civilization Fund Act just speaks volumes.
Well, I think it was, you know, and as I said, it was a very forward thinking at the time and more humane than just outright extermination. And also far more cost effective. You know, war is expensive. And I think particularly, you know, after the Civil War in Ulysses S. Grant during his presidency, he created what he called the peace policy. And again, it was like, well, I imagine the financial coffers of the federal government were rather low, and warring with tribes was expensive. And this was considered a much more humane alternative. I like to call it sort of a kinder, gentler imperialism.
You write that Native families were coerced by the federal government and Catholic Church officials into sending their kids to live and attend classes at these boarding schools. Tell us about how your mom ended up at the St. Mary's boarding school in Wisconsin.
Well, as I said, her family was really struggling. And disintegrated. My grandfather was World War I veteran, and he served in the infantry. So one can only imagine he probably had untreated PTSD. And they had five children, and you know the family disintegrated. And it was the other extended family. They were unable to offer care, so the Catholic Church really served a lot of ways as social welfare, or early social welfare programming in Indian country. So they were turned over to the sister school, to the nuns who ran the St. Mary's mission there. And so my mother was five, and you know, they were taken there. And you know, of course, not much explanation was offered. But my mother, one, she was abandoned, you know, by her mother and her family. And I think that was very, really devastating for her. And I don't think she ever recovered from it. And I think that is a thing just in general, when we are abandoned by our parents, and we maybe have a sense that love and care is, you know, it's contingent on things. It's not just something we can count on. I think that, you know, not everybody is able to survive that. You know, that's a pretty devastating experience for a child.
How long did your mom stay at that boarding school?
Well, my grandfather would periodically sober up, and he would take them out, and then he would go off on a toot, and then they would go back. So that whole series occurred quite a number of times. So she was five, and then eventually I think she went to high school at a federal boarding school in South Dakota. So she was still from five till like 17. She was in these schools.
You write about how you would often interrogate your mom about her life at this school, and she would say, "Why do you always have to go poking?" Can you just talk about what you remember about those conversations?
Yes, well, she would often be, they had to emerge, she didn't really respond very well to direct questioning. And I think it was really painful for her. You know, she was able to develop kind of a story, a cover story kind of for her mental health. And she really didn't want to give too much detail. And it was really only later that I was able to learn some more of the really painful details of what happened to her just in her life and at the boarding school. She always would tell me these stories when I was a child. It was almost like that was sort of my, my Mother Goose stories. I got to hear the sister school stories instead. And in her story, she always triumphed, over all of the hurt and pain. But in real life, she didn't. And, she'd always would speak about this particular nun who was very brutal. And in her memory, the nun one time fell down the cellar steps and hit her head and eventually died. And it was around the Christmas season. And my mother said, "Wow, Vivi, it was terrible, but us kids all did a silent cheer." And I just assumed it was a story. It was just one of these stories. But I was at the archives. The Catholics actually have a very well-preserved, organized archive, unlike any of the other churches, or unlike the federal government even, at Marquette University in Milwaukee. And I was spending some time in the archives, and I didn't find very much detail about her personally, but I found in, the sort of like administrative correspondence, that was pretty pretty well documented, particularly in relationship to finances, because otherwise, obviously, they wouldn't be paid. And there was a whole correspondence between the sister secretary at St. Mary's School in Odena and the head of the Indian Boarding Mission School in Washington, D.C., and it describes exactly what my mother described of Sister Mary Catherine falling down the cellar steps, hitting her head, and then later dying. And so I, when I read that, I was alone in this huge reading room. I remember I just stood straight up out of my chair. I could not believe it.
That really stood out reading your piece. I can't even imagine how that affected you at that moment, because you'd always wondered if that was a true story. And there you have it. It really happened.
Yes, all of, these things that she would tell me about. And it's interesting, in Odena, people still talk. It's sort of become, a story that people tell, and people would tell the story about Sister Catherine. But, I found this actual documentation of it. And I think often people will refer to, some Native people will talk about the impact of these past traumas on how some of how it has forwarded some of the social ills that we have, our high rates of alcoholism or various other problems. And maybe looking at that as sort of we're seeking an excuse, for our behavior. But, for me, I did not view it in that way. For me, it was validating and gave me a little authority over everything that had happened to her. Right. And just the way that she was, and the way that I've seen the way my family was, that these things did happen, to her. They were real. And that, and I think that's really what a lot of Native people would like to see from the federal government and Christian denominations, particularly the Catholic Church, is just some transparency.
Exactly. And some acknowledgement. And before we go to break, I just want to mention one more thing. It's important to also just learn and understand how even a label like Dirty Indian could affect someone for the rest of their lives. You write that your mom raged against the nun's label, Dirty Indian, haunted by the fear that they were right, even as she scrubbed miles of floors and performed hours of heavy manual labor. She would spend hours washing the laundry, white, like the sisters taught her, rushing up and down the cellar steps with baskets of heavy, wet sheets. She'd say, "We may be Indian, but by God, we ain't dirty."
Yeah. Yeah. And when you speak to a number of people from have had similar experiences, they will talk about their mothers, their parents being absolutely obsessed with cleanliness. And I think it was sort of, framed in this fearfulness, about validating that label of being dirty, yeah. A dirty Indian.
Today, we're speaking with Mary Annette Pember, whose mother, Bernice, was a survivor of the St. Mary's Catholic Indian Boarding School on the Ojibwe Reservation in Odana. Is it Odana?
It's Odena.
Odena, thank you. Odena, Wisconsin. Mary writes that everything was taken from her, her parents, her language, her Indian name, and her very spirit. Her mom passed on September 19th, 2011, and you can find Mary's pieces about her mom at yourcallradio.org. Mary Annette Pember is a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. She's a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about Indian boarding schools in the United States, which served as a model for Canada's residential schools. And we're joined by Mary Annette Pember, a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. She's a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. She's been writing about Indian boarding schools for 30 years. Her mom, Bernice, was a survivor of the St. Mary's Catholic Indian boarding school on the Ojibwe Reservation in Odena, Wisconsin. You can find her piece at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions for Mary, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Mary, so far we're getting a couple generic emails, general emails, I should say, from listeners who are saying, thank you for sharing this history. I just didn't know.
Yeah. I was speaking to Christine McCleave, who's the executive director of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. And she estimates that maybe 10% of the U.S. population has an awareness about this history. And I think she's, you know, perhaps being optimistic, but that's probably accurate.
What is taught in schools today about boarding schools? Anything? I didn't learn anything about them.
I don't think so. I don't think there is anything taught about it.
Wow. So you learn about the missions in fourth grade, although that is slowly going away. Teachers are really changing that part of the curriculum. But this is not being taught.
No. And I think it's just really too painful for a lot of people to think that, you know, that has been the history of our country. You know, that this is just, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, just one example of the extensive kind of assimilation policies that the federal government engaged in against Native people.
And it was so fascinating to learn you were on NPR talking about the fact that Canada's residential schools were modeled after the Indian boarding school in the United States.
Yes, and I think, you know, for the same purposes, to opening up Canada for settlers, for white settlers. And, you know, that was why it was created here in the U.S., as I said, a kind of gentler imperialism, you know, versus outright extermination. And Canada was looking for a way to, quote unquote, deal with their Indian problem, and heard about, Colonel Pratt's school of Carlisle in Pennsylvania, and went on to visit, and was impressed, and decided that this would be something that they could do in Canada. However, in Canada, it was a little bit different. They like contracted out with the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church ran, I think, most of the residential schools there. And they pretty much, I think, you know, forced people to go there. In the U.S., the policy sort of changed over the years. You know, you would be, they would withhold rations from people, or they would chase kids down, I think, during the heyday. And then later it sort of became, well, if you want, you know, you had to educate your child, but there was really no place to send them. I mean, few people, they could go to public school, but often would be a great distance away. And they probably, children were not very welcome, Native children, at those public schools. And if they were located in a border town, a town on the edge of, you know, just off the reservation. So people would often end up sending their kids to these Christian denominational schools, which still, you know, it still kind of sent that universal message of wrongness and badness about Native culture, and the need to drop those associations and to surrender yourself to the American sort of capitalism vision of the world. And, you know, to pursue basically the training that they offered was like usually half day of school, and kids would have to work or be trained. And it was usually like the domestic arts for girls and for boys, farming, maybe some skilled labor. But we were not really meant to be, I think, equals, you know, in American society. We were envisioned as servants.
It was interesting to learn more about Carlyle. Vox had a mini doc about this, and they spoke to Christine McCleave with the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. And she said that if you search Indian residential schools, photos from Carlyle will come up. And that's because Lieutenant Richard Pratt hired a photographer to take before and after photos of the children to show that his experiment was working. So before, they had long hair, they were in their own clothing, and after, they were wearing like a blazer with short hair. And she said he created propaganda, and it was so successful because the Carlyle model then really swept the country.
Well, and, you know, we have to remember the time. You know, I mean, he was seen as quite the reformer. You know, as I said, versus certainly kinder than outright extermination, you know, that Native people can be trained, you know, we can participate as servants again. And so it was, I think in that era, you know, is viewed very favorably.
Can you talk more about the treatment of children in Indian boarding schools? I mean, it varies widely. But
yes.
What we learned yesterday, and this has been out for years because Canada has had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there were so many oral stories from survivors. And, you know, I just want to warn listeners now, what I'm going to say is very disturbing. But they talk about how priests would rape young girls and then they would throw the babies in incinerators. I mean, these are just absolutely horrific stories. We heard about malnutrition, where the kids would eat food that they had never tasted before, and it was horrible, and they would throw up on a regular basis. In many cases, they would starve. They were not clothed properly. What about Indian boarding schools in the United States? Are the stories as brutal?
You know, I hadn't heard the throwing of the babies in the incinerators. And there are a lot of, like, unfortunately, a lot of extreme stories. And, you know, since we have very little history to go on, all we really have here in the United States is stories. The National Archives does have quite a few records, but their organizing schemes changed over the years as various administrations would come in, and it's difficult. It really requires a big commitment, you know, on one's part to go to read, you know, these to go through these archives, and a great deal of travel. Some records may be located in Seattle, some would be in Kansas City, some would be in Chicago, and they wouldn't necessarily be close to where you would think they would be. So it's you have to have a big commitment if you're going to sort of delve into any of the writings, and you're probably not going to find anything, you know, reflective of any of that kind of really negative treatment. Although one of the things that I found very striking is looking at the government frequently would send out pre-printed forms, particularly to the Catholics, because the Catholics did get reimbursed from Indian trust funds, and in the forms, and also I think the federal schools as well. So in their rosters that they would keep for the children, there would be, it was just a print, you know, a category in a form would be the child graduated, they left school, they ran away, or they died. So, I mean, it was just a category. So, I mean, it was something that, you know, people died there. And, you know, we have to remember as well that, you know, during the Great Depression, particularly for Native people who already, you know, were often living a very marginal existence because of past policies by the federal government that displacing them from their traditional ways of providing food for themselves, hunting and and fishing on their lands. You know, really the boarding schools were the only possible choice for many families. It was either that or, you know, potential starvation. So, you know, and the Catholics did, you know, they were very, very good, though, at fundraising. You have to admire that about them. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, my mother spoke of being hungry all the time. Mm-hmm. And they would always, kids were always on the outlook to steal food. They had a dairy there at the school, and she recalls being in the milking parlor, and if you could steal a cup of cream, you would just chug it, like, really fast. Wow. There would be these small, or she also told me about stealing an apple from the cellar. The nuns kept an extensive root cellar, and she was beaten really brutally for eating that apple. you know, things like that. It was, you know, they, I think that, you know, they were not very well funded, and there wasn't a whole lot of oversight either, you know, at the school. So it was often a difficult existence.
Do you think the Vatican has records of what happened in the United States? Because the guests that we had on yesterday from Canada are calling on the Vatican to send records back to Canada so they can see the documentation.
Well, we have, the records are here. At Marquette University, at a special collection, which at Marquette University is a Catholic university in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But they keep those records rather close. You have to make a special appointment to go in and view them. And there's been a big call to digitize them. They have a wealth of items there. But the Catholic Church does seem to like to control the narrative about not only about Native people, their relationship with Native people, but I think their relationship to many other issues, such as, like, you know, their abuse of children. I think it wasn't not only Native people have been abused by some of the priests, but certainly, you know, everybody, many other students were as well. And there's a great deal of talk about reconciliation in this country and healing. But, you know, I think what a lot of people, Native people, are countering, well, before we can move to that, you know, we've got to have some transparency first. And it should be not, and it should be just absolute transparency, not guided by, you know, an outcome that, you know, that the church or others would like to see. And it, the reconciliation needs to come from Native people. Right. I think, but people, you know, I think the Catholic Church in particular, and perhaps, you know, I don't know what's really, you know, the thinking in the federal government, but, you know, that just more open access so that people can have maybe the somewhat of the similar experience, validating experience that I had, just seeing my mother's name and her siblings' names listed in the roster was just very powerful for me. It just, as I said, gave me some authority over what happened to her and what happened to our family.
So at the Special Collections Library at Marquette University in Milwaukee, you say they keep these documents very close. Who keeps them close?
Well, they have an archivist there, and, you know, they just really do guard access to that archive. Yeah.
And so this is one place, but do you think there are records in other places like the Vatican, for example?
You know, did they send them to the Vatican? I don't know. I mean, because, you know, the reason that, as I said, you know, finances had a big impact on these, the preservation of these records. I mean, you wouldn't get paid unless you had some sort of verification that these children actually attended. So I don't know if the Vatican, you know, I don't know about Canada, and I'm not completely sure in the U.S. I did note, you know, in some of my research that they talked about making three copies of all of these records, one that the school would keep and one that the mission office in Washington, D.C. would keep, and then one that the federal government would keep. So there was no mention about records being sent to the Vatican, but they could have been. You know, and I think what is really stunning is that, you know, the Pope has still not apologized. He actually refused again. Right. To apologize. Right. Although many Native people talk about, well, an apology itself would not mean that much, but more of just, I think, a direct acknowledgement without any caveats, you know, like, oh, we didn't really mean it, you know, we were misinformed, but just like, just a straight up acknowledgement. And that's what needs to come first.
Today we're speaking with Mary Annette Pember, a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. She's a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. She's been writing about Indian boarding schools for the last 30 years. Her mother, Bernice, was a survivor of the St. Mary's Catholic Indian Boarding School on the Ojibwe Reservation in Odena, Wisconsin. And you can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Sandy who says, I grew up in Fullerton, California. Each month, my parents would take us to the Salton Sea for water skiing. This was in the 1960s. We would drive by the Sherman Boarding School in Riverside, and my mom would say, that's where the Indian children live. I remember it startled me, staying with me for a long time and prompted me to learn more. The history of Indian boarding schools is so very troubling. Well, thank you for the email, Sandy. You can email us yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. You write about unmarked graves that have been found in the United States. You spoke with Llewellyn White, an associate professor of Indigenous Studies at Concordia University in Montreal, who located 11 unmarked graves of Carlisle students who died during the outing program. This was a program where students were, quote, lent to non-Native people who used them as low-cost labor for domestic help. Can you tell us about what she found and what came of that?
You know, I don't think much has come of it. She's really compelled to continue to look. I mean, the outing program, I have evidence of it happening at least at a couple of other schools. She thought it had only happened at Carlisle, but I think it was a fairly common practice. And the kids would, you know, if they were usually probably teenage age by that time, and if they would go to these non-Native homes, and sometimes they would die, and, you know, perhaps the school wasn't even notified, and then maybe the parents were notified some months later. You know, and often the locations of the burials were lost. So she just felt really compelled to find out, you know, the location of some of the graves. And she was able to find, I think it was in Philadelphia, in a paupers area of a cemetery. They were buried three deep. Mm-hmm. But I think that was somewhat of the practice in that era that, you know, I think particularly, you know, in if there was a lack of funding, that people were often buried more than one to a grave. But she felt some sense of that she'd accomplished what she wanted, she felt she needed to do, which was just to find where these children, you know, where they were interred, and to make some ceremony for them.
You also write that in 2016, Marcia Small, a citizen of the Northern Cheyenne tribe, used radar to look for unmarked graves at the Chemawa Indian School near Salem, Oregon, as part of her master's thesis at Montana State University. She says her research indicates there may be hundreds of unmarked graves at that site.
Yes, and, you know, as I said before, since, you know, there were a great number of schools, and surely they must have had cemeteries associated with them. There have been a lot of, over the years, tribes have, you know, wanted to find some way to search for the graves, the unmarked graves, or this ground sensing radar, but it's expensive. And, you know, I think a few tribes have been successful, but, you know, we've got to think certainly that there, you know, there are, you know, several Kamloops in, you know, the location of the 215 graves in Canada. There are several of those in the United States. There have to be.
Well, and in Canada, they're saying that the Canadian government is going to pay for some of this advanced technology to find these graves. It seems like that would be a no-brainer here in the United States.
Yeah, you'd think. But like I said, there just hasn't really been the will. And then off on as well, you know, Native folks have got some more immediate problems, I think, of the living. And perhaps that may, you know, that guides, particularly coming out of a pandemic now, that may guide a lot of their energy and attention. But certainly there have been, you know, a lot of people looking for that kind of information.
You know, you bring up such a good point that there are other issues, like, for example, running water on the Navajo Nation and other places around the country. These issues are so big, Mary, and I'm just wondering, when it comes to awareness raising, changing the curriculum, you know, things like putting wayside exhibits in places to let people know about the history. I mean, I'm kind of floored. You know, I went to a mission, I think it was in San Luis Obispo or one of those areas recently. And I mean, the writing was like fifth grade. Some of the words were even spelled wrong. I mean, it was just so insulting. I mean, there's just so much work to be done just to provide the basics at this point in 2021.
Yes, yes. But you know, what do they say? A journey of 1,000 miles, it begins with one step. So, you know, I think we're just even acknowledging it is a big deal in this country. And, you know, we look at, I think the George Floyd murder really has been one of the sparks that has moved us forward in the U.S. And, you know, a lot of people are coming into that kicking and screaming. They don't really want to learn about that stuff. And then there's a lot of effort to dismiss it. But, you know, I think that we're experiencing in this country, I think, an awakening and perhaps a will to at least examine some of the truth of what really happened in this country.
Right. And as you say, it's also important to focus on the incredible activism that is happening. Native people on the front lines of Line 3, for example, a number of people just got arrested over the past couple weeks. Yes. The work that they did on Keystone XL, which has now been canceled. There's so much incredible activism happening on the ground. And I feel like we're getting so many new books about history and then contemporary Natives from Native authors. There's new movies, documentaries coming out. I mean, there's just a lot happening.
Well, that's the upside of, you know, of the forced assimilation. I mean, you know, you send us to school and we become lawyers and we kind of educated. And so we start learning, you know, how to walk the walk and talk the talk. And, you know, Native people are very intelligent people, just like other groups of people. And, you know, I always describe us as the consummate scientists. You know, what is science but science is observation based. And we've often lived, you know, in these places for, you know, about hundreds and arguably thousands of years. And we've noticed a few things over that period of time. And, you know, we have this incredibly valuable knowledge. I think that, you know, the mainstream world is just starting to realize might be valuable for, well, addressing issues such as climate change.
What are your thoughts on the media coverage of all of this? I mean, you've been doing this work for a long time. It was amazing to read that you were the first Native woman staff photographer at four papers, including the Arizona Republic and the Oregonian. Can you talk about some of the changes that you've seen over the years?
Well, yes, there have been a lot. I mean, often I would be the only woman. I'd be the first woman. And that unto itself was difficult, particularly as a photographer. It's also in the day when I began, it was really seen as a very much of a male-dominated occupation. So we're seeing, you know, no longer, and it was often not a very friendly environment. And there certainly was, you know, the men didn't check themselves on the way they would treat you. And often it was not very supportive and very judgmental. And I found that difficult, you know, but I was able to learn some really good things about journalism and to, you know, kind of continue on and finally just go off and do my own thing. I you know, left mainstream journalism and wanted to write about Native people. And I just started doing that, and darned if they didn't pay me. So, you know, that's what I've been doing now for the, you know, since about 03. There have been changes. Sometimes I lament the particularly in media, you know, the lack of change, how long it's taken people. I remember where I'm past president of the Native American Journalists Association, and I was elected in 1999, and we were always being, you know, approached by mainstream media. Well, we want more representation of Native people. We want more people of color. But, you know, they would hire us, and then it would be very much measure us only by their own measures. You know, you were really successful in as much as you were able to, you know, walk that walk and talk that talk. You weren't really valued for what you brought as a person of color to the newsroom. And consequently, a lot of people left, like I did. So it's taken, I'm just going to name the New York Times actually called and wanted me to do a freelance assignment. And they wanted, it was on a reservation in Michigan, and they called because they wanted an indigenous photographer. And I was just told the editor how really pleased I was that she was searching for an indigenous photographer. It only took I began in this business in 86. So it's only taken 40 years, but people are, I applaud that. And I see that as a step forward. My better days. And then, as I said, on my not so good days, I'm just so utterly disgusted. I can't even talk about it.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's like we move forward and then we go back. And then you see what, for example, Rick Santorum said, those horrific comments, we birthed the nation from nothing. I mean, there was nothing here. And because of Native pressure, CNN dropped him. Although I did read that they gave him a chance to apologize on Chris Cuomo's show, and he did not apologize, and that was it. And so you have to wonder, how many Native people work at CNN, MSNBC, New York Times? I think very few, if maybe none.
Yeah, I don't think CNN has anybody. Maybe they do, but you know, we decided in Indian Country Today, we just didn't give Rick Santorum any time to speak of, because we really have, I mean, that sort of thing happens so much. We decided not to elevate it. It wasn't an important part of our discussion and what we're about. You know, it was reported it and we moved on. There's just so many more important things. There's always some, you know, misinformed or, you know, ill-informed person making these kind of statements in the United States. You grow up with it as a Native person and you choose whether to expend your energy, you know, reacting to it or not. And there's just, it happens so often. You just have to choose to ignore it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't stay angry all the time, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that would account for, you know, if you think of people of color have been when they're high rates of high blood pressure. I mean, that would account for that. You know, how, you know, you get so all these, they call them quote unquote microaggressions, but those kinds of like little, like those comments and that sort of stuff that you experience, you know, I think from your coworkers, perhaps, I mean, they really cut you very deeply and they can really make you feel just so angry and diminished as a, you know, both of, you know, of your, both emotionally and physically. And so you really have to, try to ignore it, but that also does it takes a toll on us.
It definitely does. But I also just wanted to end, we're almost out of time, but you've done such great reporting, and I also want to encourage people to read your Type Investigations report that found for the greater part of the 20th century the federal government routed funds designated as direct payments for Native people to Catholic mission schools, draining families of $30 million by today's measure. And this was a massive investigation, and it got a lot of attention. So thank you, Mary, for joining us, and thank you for all of your incredible reporting. We'd love to have you back.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Marionette Pember is a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. She's a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. Her mother, Bernice, was a survivor of the St. Mary's Catholic Indian Boarding School on the Ojibwe Reservation in Odena, Wisconsin. And you can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.